Here's what I know about knee pain. It really hurts. Go to the Joint Relief Institute, and they will address it for you. The Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park in Oak Brook uses digital imaging. They see where the tissue's deteriorated, and then they put a lubricant right there, and it really, really works. You know, we've just had the loveliest of summers. And now going into the fall, I want you to be able to take advantage of any and every single day that you can pain-free. Lord knows you need it this year. If you go to the Joint Relief Institute, they see where that tissue's gone away. They put a lubricant in there and it works. Pain-free, non-surgical procedure. And it's almost surely going to be covered by your insurance. They got somebody to help you out with that. So with confidence, limp in there and then smile on your way out. Here's how you reach them. JointReliefInstitute.com or call 708-888-0000. Zero as in zero pain.
Good afternoon. It is Thursday, September 3rd, 1:45 in the afternoon. I'm Steve Bertrand, and this is The Mincing Rascals without Sean Williams, which is, of course, a source of great sadness for all of us, but we're going to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and do the very best we can.
I'm Heather Sharon with WTTW News.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Eric Zorn, a columnist from the Tribune, who will vote only once, no matter what my president tells me to do.
And then if they tabulate it very late, which they shouldn't be doing, they'll see you voted, and so it won't count. So send it in early, and then go and vote. And if it's not tabulated, you vote.
Well, I think he wants you to test the system out by breaking the law, doesn't he, Eric? Isn't that what they're looking for?
I won't do it. I will only vote once because voting twice is illegal.
Even here in Illinois these days.
Even in Illinois, even in Chicago.
Explain that for people. What happened this week?
Well, when Trump was down in North Carolina, he, in one of his, I'm assuming it was unscripted quip, he suggested to people that they vote twice, once by mail and once in person, in order to test the system to see if it actually works. Now, telling someone to do that is basically asking them to commit voter fraud.
Which is also a felony.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy. And it's all part of his effort, I think, to preemptively undermine the election results so that he can claim victory no matter what happens.
Right. So he was asking people to check on the system by committing voter fraud to prove that there was voter fraud in the system.
Yeah, it's kind of like saying, go to your local Walmart and stick a few items in your pants and walk out just to see if the system will catch you. I mean, except it's probably worse because, as Heather points out, it's a felony to vote twice.
Well, let me just tell you, Walmart, it never works, but it used to at Kmart. Austin?
No matter what politicians say, just vote once. I will do a special public service announcement. The Illinois Board of Elections keeps telling people that people in my circle don't know about, which is if you're requesting a ballot by mail, it can be tough to then, you need to bring that ballot back in person if you're going to go vote in person. People are doing it as like kind of an insurance policy, like, maybe I'll vote by mail, maybe not. That means you got to do the vote by mail.
No, that's a really important point because I did not realize that either. I thought if you applied for it and you used it, then it's fine. But if you didn't use it, you could vote that day. But that's not the case.
Correct.
All right, so this week there was a...
It's also different in different states. So every state has a little bit of a different rule. So like in a state like New York, for example, there's absolutely nothing wrong with applying for a mail ballot and then going to vote in person. You don't need the ballot in New York. They just have you cast a provisional ballot. So that's why it's so chaotic and frankly dangerous for the president to do stuff like this, because there was a woman in Iowa who voted early by mail in 2016 and then tried to vote in person and was charged with a felony because she said she wanted to test the system. So this is not a hypothetical sort of maybe somebody would do this. You know, this has happened before and it will happen again.
All right, we'll get back to the candidates for president in a bit, but let's go to the governor's mansion, actually to the Speaker of the House and the Illinois legislature. They announced this week a special investigative committee after Jim Durkin, the Republican leaders and others asked for it, to look into the ComEd agreement and Michael Madigan's connection to it. Heather, explain that for me.
Well, so if you can cast your memory back like a month or so, ComEd admits in federal court that they engaged in sort of a years-long bribery scheme tied to their push for rate hikes and subsidies. And implicated in that agreement, although not named and not charged, is House Speaker Michael Madigan, who says that he's done nothing wrong. But this is sort of the next shoe dropping on this, because this is only the third time that this sort of special investigative committee has been formed. And this committee, which is evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, will have the power to issue subpoenas and hold hearings. And I'll defer to Austin on what he thinks the likelihood of them moving to oust Madigan is. But, you know, the thing I'd say about these sort of hearings is that you never know where they're going to go. Well, you never know what Pandora's box you're going to open.
Could Madigan have refused to do this or not? Or was it automatic if it's requested that it's established?
I mean, he recused himself and he let Greg Harris, his sort of number two, make the decision. So, you know, I guess in theory, he could have not recused himself and blocked the creation of this. That seems somewhat
Madigan-esque.
For lack of a better term.
Well, it's problematic either way, right? Because the Republicans took advantage of a little used part of the legislative procedure to do this. And the question I have, and Heavy, I don't know if you have an answer to this, is this: does this committee require four votes for a subpoena? If they want to subpoena someone, can they do it with three votes? How does that work?
So as I understand it, that they have to set the rules once they meet. So we don't really know what those rules are going to be, which leaves open the possibility that it's not going to go anywhere because you're just going to have a deadlock, right? You're going to have, you know, two and two and nobody's going to go anywhere. You know, the problem with that is that I think that the Democrats will feel at least some pressure to at least go through some sort of motions of some sort of, you know, hearings and subpoenas and investigation. But, you know, I'm going to guess that my good friend Austin is relatively cynical about the chances.
If anyone has faith in government, I think it's Austin Berg.
Oh, it's Austin.
So what does he think is going to happen here?
So the point about the subpoenas is really interesting, and it's especially ironic because the actual legislative inspector general in Springfield has more handcuffs on issuing subpoenas than this committee that is, you know, convened by other lawmakers, which is absurd. I would appreciate, I think Heather's point, that's my reading of the rule too. We don't quite know what the rules will be on how subpoenas will be issued. The rules are laid out in terms of charging Madigan or levying discipline upon him. That would require a majority vote, 4-2 vote in the committee, and then that would be brought to the full House and they would vote on discipline there. So I would appreciate if Governor Pritzker, instead of saying that perhaps this is a good, you know, good way to find out information about the House Speaker, who in this document is said to have installed a board member and named jobs from meter reader on up at this massive utility, here's some things they should subpoena. Here's specifically the answers that he needs to request. Instead, it's just more wishy-washy stuff. As Heather said, I think it's too early to say what exactly will come from the committee.
I want to take a little bit of exception to the idea that Pritzker is wishy-washy. He did come out and say, I want to hear answers. He was basically speaking in favor of the formation of this committee. I know he's part of what I call if troop, the people who are like, if this is true, then this, which I think is a pretty weaselly way of handling it. But Pritzker was saying that he wants answers, and he said that all along. And my view of this whole episode, this whole attempt, is that it's not really about getting a 4-2 vote to oust Madigan. It's about holding hearings. It's about the optics of there being in Springfield or wherever they do it, probably do it on Zoom, but of people being called before this committee, people on ComEd, people on the speaker's staff being called before this committee to answer questions that, you know, there may not be these horrible answers to. I've always thought that Madigan is probably pretty careful, and you're not going to find a bunch of smoking guns in his office. But that the episode is going to prove to be embarrassing and difficult for Madigan, which I think is the point.
Well, I was wondering, my next question was going to be, go ahead, Austin.
Well, yeah, it's only going to be embarrassing if they actually ask questions that he can answer, right? So you can't just ask for answers. you have to ask the committee to get documents and get answers to specific questions. Because, you know, as it stands right now, Madigan's given all the answers. He said, I've never put somebody in a position in exchange for, I've never named somebody to like a make work job in exchange for my actions in Springfield. So that's his answer. What other answers does Pritzker want? And what questions should this, what action should this committee take to get answers?
Well, I'll start with that. I mean, I'd like to know, what did Madigan know and when did he know it about all the bribery that was going on underneath him? And what I've written and what I believe is that if he didn't know about what was going on underneath him, then he's incompetent. And if he did know, he's crooked. There's really only two choices here, which is why I think it's this is really bad for Madigan. If the Democrats stonewall this, if they say, no, we're not going to have witnesses, no, you can't have these documents, that's going to look really bad, too. I mean, this is just a win-win-win for the Republicans who are after him. I don't see any downside to them because, yeah, they're probably not going to get a 4-2 or 5-1 vote to get rid of Madigan. I'm not sure that that's their end game.
Well, I was going to say, though, in the end, if Madigan is going to be removed or forced to resign, it's not going to come from this committee, right? It's going to come from federal prosecutors. Correct or incorrect?
No, it could come from his caucus. Right?
It could come from you think that this caucus is that weak behind him?
Well, if they've had six or seven defections. I'm sorry, Heather, go ahead.
I was just gonna say I also think it depends on what happens in November. If the House increases its, you know, supermajority, if the Democrats increase their supermajority, Madigan's position is going to be strengthened. If they don't gain seats as many people expect them to, I think that that will be seen as a sign that Madigan has hurt the party. And I think if the graduated income tax ballot measure goes down, I think all bets are off. And that could trigger a full-scale revolt because people, whether correctly or incorrectly, will point to Madigan, will point to the coverage of the scandal as something that potentially could doom that effort. And if that effort goes down, I mean, I don't want to use the words fiscal Armageddon, but I'm using the words fiscal Armageddon. That could topple Madigan as well.
Well, the city is facing fiscal Armageddon, and they talked about the budget today a little bit on this Thursday afternoon. I think earlier this week, Mayor Lightfoot said, it's an $800 million deficit this year, $1.2 billion for next year. They're going to prepare their budget for next year without the idea of getting any federal help. And they say property taxes will be the last on the list, but everything is on the list if possible.
Yeah. Plus layoffs, plus sales tax hikes, plus random tax hikes on things that we didn't even know really that the city taxed. Like if you lease a computer, you pay a 7% tax. Apparently that is less than what you pay on a leased car. You pay 9% to the city on that. So the mayor is going to raise that up to 9%. But look, there are no good options. Like, there good options left a long time ago. So, you know, this is layoffs. This is services being cut. This is, you know, really everything on the chopping block. I keep saying, you know, people keep asking me, well, you know, is it really that bad? And I keep saying, yes, it's really that bad. So without a federal bailout of some amount, the city's in really bad shape because its expenses are just way outstripping revenues right now. And about $800 million of that projected deficit in 2021 is due to the coronavirus. But the city is still facing a structural deficit of somewhere in the neighborhood of $420 million, which, you know, is a lot of money.
Even by radio host standards.
So what? But all of this again is without the idea of there being any federal money. Do we think there's going to, in the end, be federal money?
So I think it depends on how bad the economy gets in the next month or so, right? Because if the economy gets significantly worse, and that's not to say the economy is good now, I think there will be increasing pressure on Republicans in the Senate to reopen negotiations over some sort of relief or stimulus package. However, the prospects of major legislation 60 days to a presidential election, those aren't very good odds. Now, does something different happen if Biden is elected and Trump is a lame duck? maybe. Does Biden take office in January and make this sort of his first priority to help states and cities that are struggling as the economy has worsened? You know, I don't know. There's always the possibility that the city could come back and revise its budget. Its budget if federal help materializes.
Eric, do you think that Joe Biden will have served his second term before Ed Burke comes to trial?
Well, certainly sounds like it. His lawyers were in court this week saying, and he's going to be tried with two other people, which I guess I hadn't been aware of. And they were basically pointing out that this is going to create an enormous courtroom full of people who are going to want to be there, just the lawyers and the assistants and so on. And that there's those mountains of evidence that the state has provided to these attorneys that they need time to go through. So between the coronavirus and the amount of evidence, they are saying that it's not going to. It was going to happen next year, 2021, right? And now they think it's not even going to happen then. Burke is up for re-election in 2023. And the pace of justice in the federal system is kind of mind-boggling.
So there are three issues. One, it's the pandemic. There hasn't been a large jury trial since it began. There, it's also the possibility that if they move forward with a jury trial during the pandemic, that socially distancing regulations and that sort of thing could be used by the defense teams to challenge the appropriateness of the trial, so it could be tossed out even if they get it done, whatever the outcome. If Burke and his co-defendants are convicted, it could be tossed out. So that's something that the prosecution has to think about as well. But there are also going to be huge fights over the evidence in this trial. And one of the fights is going to center on the role of former Alderman Danny Solis, who is expected to testify against Burke. And in return for that testimony and his help in the investigation, he's entered a deferred prosecution agreement, just like ComEd, where basically if he lives up to the, you know, what it calls for, he won't face jail time. So Burke's lawyers have already indicated that they're going to challenge that. And they're also challenging the wiretap warrants that the federal government got to tap his city hall phone lines and his cell phone lines. And he's going to use the Supreme Court decisions in the corruption trial of former Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell, who basically said, you know, it was just politics, which we all in Illinois, of course, remember as the Blagojevich defense. And that is going to have to go through not only a decision by the trial judge, but potentially survive on appeal. Because let's not forget, Burke has just less than all the money in the world to fight this.
Okay, let's go on our Wayback Machine, Eric, the defense of it was just politics. Who was the city treasurer who was charged? It was a woman who was a city treasurer.
Miriam Santos,
right. And that's kind of what the critics of her conviction said, was that it was just politics being done.
Yeah. Well, as Heather points out, that was the Blagojevich line. This was just political horse trading is what he said. I don't think that'll work for Burke. My question is, how much does it really matter given how Burke has been defanged right now? Yes, he represents the 14th Ward. Yes, he's still on the city council. He's one of 50 votes there. But he is basically, now Heather, you go to these meetings. I don't. He's kind of a non-entity, right? He doesn't even talk much anymore.
You know, he talks much less. And he's certainly much less powerful. However, I think you can probably make an argument that he's still powerful behind the scenes. You hear, allegations all the time of him working through other aldermen as his proxy. And I think we have to ask ourselves that, like, it's one thing to say, you know what, he's an old man, he's been defanged, like, you know, he's not really, you know, running the show anymore. But there's a significant amount of evidence that he wasted millions of taxpayer dollars over the course of his chairmanship of the finance committee, and that he, you know, used his roles to profit through his law firm. And, you know, there's probably a good government argument to be made that is why he should be prosecuted and held to account. Because if we're ever going to get out from under this sort of corruption tax that I know Austin has written a lot about, people like Burke have to be held to account whether they're convicted or not convicted.
Well, I agree with that. I just want to say I think that justice for him is necessary, but it doesn't feel as urgent as perhaps it would have if he was still chairman of the Finance
Committee. Austin, what do you make of that?
Austin, what do you go ahead?
Yeah, the urgency is interesting. So we even see, like, in New York State, for example, Sheldon Silver, who was the longtime speaker there, he was like the Madigan of New York. He was originally sentenced on corruption charges to 12 years in prison in 2016, and wasn't until this year that he actually went to prison. Like, these things can take a really long time, especially if you're a really well-heeled, long-time politician. So we shouldn't expect the Burke stuff to go quickly. I completely agree with Heather. It's a perception thing that, as much as a justice thing, you need to show people that that kind of behavior won't be tolerated. That said, this is kind of the problem with bad apple style corruption policing, where we just say, okay, you know, once we get this guy in prison, then the corruption problem's done. Well, Illinois has had nearly 900 public corruption convictions since 2000, which is about one per week for 20 years running. So clearly that doesn't fix the corruption problem. I would also just note, Ed Burke is a large part of the reason for the discussion that we had just before this, which is the massive financial hole that the city of Chicago is in. And that Burke-style budgeting remains today. And the style is spend way too much, have way too high fixed costs, and borrow the difference. And that's why Chicago was a junk-rated city before COVID. It's not because of COVID. Certainly, there's going to be a big hole because of COVID, but it was a very fragile system because of the types of deals that Burke would make with taxpayer money.
He certainly doesn't have the support of the mayor. And, you know, there was a time when a sitting mayor could have turned his back or her back on an alderman and sort of forced them out. That's not where we are today. Alderman or Mayor Lightfoot, when she was running, said she wanted 50 strong voices from the wards. I think she's getting that. I mean, what is your assessment of the relationship between the mayor and the city council and the power that she has there?
I mean, it's not great. I mean, there was a reason why in her budget speech, she made a point of saying, look, I understand that I have contributed to the toxicity in the world, and she pledged to do a better job. But we're talking about a mayor who was elected on her promise to reduce the power of aldermen, to scale back their ability to either, you know, approve projects or veto projects. And one who has, you know, attacked aldermen who disagree with her in the most personal and direct terms. And I think that's going to be problematic now that she is looking at a situation where she's going to have to ask people to take very tough votes. And her mantra all the way along has been, I'm not a horse trader. I'm not going to give to get. You either vote with me or you don't. And as long as I've got 26 votes, I don't really care. I think that is going to be a much harder push if you're talking about a property tax hike, if you're talking about a budget that lays off, you know, hundreds of city employees, especially when you have a really sort of committed group of aldermen on the city council who see a very easy way to solve this budget deficit, and that's to reduce the $1.7 billion budget for the Chicago Police Department. So, I mean, I know I said financial Armageddon, but it's also political Armageddon because, you know, that budget pressure is going to, you know, push those calls to reduce the police department's budget significantly, because their argument is going to be, why are we raising taxes on people when we can simply reduce the amount of money we spend on this department that does nothing but make most of our Black and Latino residents feel unsafe and attacked? It's going to be quite a fight.
All right, let's go to Kenosha, because just about everybody else has. President Trump was there, I think it was Tuesday. This is Thursday afternoon. Joe Biden is still there, I think right now probably holding a roundtable. And I don't mean to be flippant when I say just about everybody else has, because, you know, the other part of it is the Kenosha County Sheriff released statistics about the number of those arrested, and I think it's something like 250 or so. And more than 150 of those, or at least half of those, were from outside of Kenosha County. So, you know, we hear here in the city about agitators revving up the looting and stuff like that. Every time there's some discord anywhere, they talk about outside agitators, which sometimes seems to me like an excuse, or it's not us, it's them. But they seem in Kenosha to have the numbers. So that's one thing. But let's talk about the politics of this and the presidential candidates going. And I'll start on this. I think Joe Biden's going to come out of this with a much better spin or bump than did President Trump. But frankly, I'm a little surprised that Biden is there so quickly, because Tony Evers, the Democratic governor of Wisconsin, made a big deal of saying it was just too soon for President Trump to visit. And the mayor of Kenosha said it was too soon. And then now, just 2 days later, you know, the Democrats are sort of having to twist all of that, because here their nominee is showing up with a love fest in Kenosha. What do you guys
push back on that a little bit? Simply because they specifically said, you know, we don't want Trump to come because he has poured gasoline on what's happened here. You know, he hasn't denounced the 17-year-old from Antioch who is charged with first-degree murder for shooting three protesters and killing two. You know, his rhetoric played a whole lot into the decision by those self-proclaimed militias to travel to Kenosha. So I don't think we can equate the two. A visit by Biden is very different than a visit by Trump, simply because of what Trump has done and said.
I think that's how they saw it. I think it's true that Trump coming there, I was really concerned that there was going to be a lot of unrest, some rioting, disorder, violence, whatever, when Trump visited. And I think that's what he wanted secretly. I think that he would have loved it if there had been people throwing rocks at his motorcade or otherwise being disruptive. And his visit up there seemed kind of like a non-event in a way. I mean, people came and he walked around the rubble a little bit, but I don't think he got the pop out of that he wanted.
That's his own fault, because he spent the day tweeting about how he hadn't had a series of mini strokes, and that the question about whether I suffered a series of mini strokes is answered by my tweet about having suffered mini strokes. And, you know,
and you just now said mini strokes three times.
I mean, that's sort of what his Twitter feed has been like the last day or so.
But, you know, Austin, it's interesting, because when Kether talks about the pop, this is an event, a singular event, where two candidates for president went and wanted very different pops, right? I mean, what they were after was completely diametrically opposed to each other.
It's fascinating. And I wish, presidents more often would go into areas to speak with families and de-escalate situations. I think that can be sometimes actually powerful for the community. Kenosha to me does seem like a pop for Trump for this reason. And it's the fact that it's a town of 100,000 in the Midwest. It's the everywhere USA, and it's going to be used. It's going to be used in ads for the next 60 days to say, hey, it's not just Portland, which you've never been to and is crazy left. It's not just Seattle. It's not just Chicago. This is happening in relatively small town Wisconsin, next to, you know, where the Mars Cheese Castle is. And that's where your town is going to go if this guy gets elected. So I could see how if you're somebody in Wisconsin who watched what happened in Kenosha and watched the destruction that took place even prior to sort of the militia stuff, and then see statements that are saying, you know, Trump ginned this up, I think that might fall on deaf ears.
Or it might fuel them.
Perhaps, yeah. So, and we haven't really seen poll numbers move too much, though, in Trump's favor to that point after Kenosha. So
well, there's a Fox poll out today in three battleground states. Wisconsin was one of them, and Biden is holding a 50-42% lead over the president there, and that's among likely voters from Fox News. He's also leading in North Carolina and Arizona. Now, again, I don't think that the Kenosha situation maybe is in this cake just yet, but there's a pretty comfortable margin right now for Vice President Biden in Wisconsin. I'm sorry, I cut you off, Heather.
Oh, I was just going to say that we've seen consistent polling after the Republican National Convention and after what happened in Kenosha that there's no that Trump has experienced no benefit from it, and that more people trust Biden on questions of public safety and trust Biden on questions of race relations. So, you know, I know that everybody saw that violence and thought, oh my gosh, you know, Trump is going to be somehow able to capitalize on that. But, you know, I think there's a reason why he's been trying to argue that Kenosha is what it would look like in Joe Biden's America.
Your vote will decide whether we protect law-abiding Americans or whether we give free rein to violent anarchists and agitators and criminals. No one will be safe in Biden's America.
Even though, of course, we all live in Donald Trump's America. And I just don't think that that argument is landing, even though we have all learned the lessons of 1968 over and over again, where Richard Nixon was able to take sort of unrest and sort of campaign on law and order.
We shall reestablish freedom from fear in America so that America can take the lead in reestablishing freedom from fear in the world. And to those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, there and here is a reply. Our goal is justice. Justice for every American.
But again, I think Nixon was not an incumbent at that point, and he was seen as somebody who's coming in to sort of calm the waters. There is no polling to suggest that, you know, except for the president's base, that anybody thinks that Trump could calm anything, and that most people, a significant majority, think that he has made the situation significantly worse.
Eric, I want to get to you, but I mean, that what Heather touched upon just speaks to where we are in this day and age in the United States of America. We have a sitting president saying, if you elect my opponent, it's going to be as bad as it is now or worse. Right. I mean, it's just it's an amazing thing. Donald Trump is the president. He's saying don't elect Joe Biden or it'll be more like this.
Well, my analysis of Kenosha is that if it turns out to have been an isolated couple of nights and we don't have a lot more of this in the next 60 days till the election, that this is going to fade in memory, that the issues are going to be the pandemic and the economy and other things. It's not going to be violence in the streets. If, however, we continue to see the sorts of things that we've been seeing, we saw in Kenosha, that we're seeing in Portland, that this may obtain somewhat, and that you're going to have people who are looking at this and thinking, I don't want this to happen in my downtown. I don't want this to happen to my business, my relatives' businesses. And, you know, I've been hoping that the left, the loony left, will calm itself down and think a little strategically. I did a column last week about, you know, there were these people in Washington, D.C. I think they were identified as Black Lives Matter protesters. I'm not sure exactly who they were representing, but they were going to restaurants and outdoor restaurants, and they were yelling at people and demanding that they raise their fist in solidarity with the movement. And it was just an ugly scene. There was a woman who identified herself as a sympathizer who refused to be bullied. And I think a lot of people see that kind of thing, and they don't want that in their town. There was an incident in Oak Park just last week where a bunch of young protesters came to the mayor's house during a village board Zoom meeting and were trashing his garden and pounding on his windows and doors. And when you have that going on, you have a lot of people who in middle America who may despise Trump, but they don't want that to happen in their communities. And so I think we're still at a fulcrum point with this issue. And that if the crazy people on the left can just realize that they've got to think strategically, if their tantrums end up reelecting Donald Trump, they're in for four more years of real hurt, at least four more years of real hurt.
Eric's column was really good. I suggest people read it. I think it came out the same day that NPR piece on the book In Defense of Looting came out, and I think I saw them right after each other, and that's the exact type of stuff. Like the fact that was getting mainstream press about how joyous and liberatory looting is, I think speaks to that concern on the left, which is a valid concern.
I don't know if we. Go ahead, Heather.
Oh, I was just going to say that everybody after the George Floyd protests said the exact same thing you know, don't protest now. It's only going to help Trump. And, you know, that was really Biden's high watermark in the polls. So, you know, I just don't, even though it feels intuitively correct to us, there's just no evidence to support that these protests, even violent looting protests, have at all helped the president. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, I just think we've got to focus on the facts. And, you know, there's so much leftover trauma from 2016 where, you know, we all thought the polls were saying one thing and it turned out that the polls were significantly wrong, that nobody feels like they can trust anything anymore. And everybody's just, you know, running around scared. But, you know, it's just, you know, all I can do is focus on the facts.
I was vacationing not too far from Antioch. I was in Wisconsin last week, so I wasn't part of the Mincing Rascals. So I don't know if you talked about this, but have we seen now, maybe are they going to start taking down the Brian Urlacher billboards around town that have been up for years? Is his hair regrowth after he retweeted and hearted a couple of, well, I don't know how you describe them, Eric, but they're inflammatory to say the least.
Well, one of them was, what was he?
It was Free Rittenhouse, I think, the teenager who fired shots in Kenosha. And the other was he talked about the day that Brett Favre's father died and went out and played anyway, equating that to the NBA players who decided to take a pause during the season in the wake of the most recent killings.
So here's what's really sad to me about Brian Urlacher is that he has a son who is black. And I am so uncomfortable with this whole conversation as, you know, sort of like, you know, Brian Urlacher being criticized and Brian Urlacher going to visit the White House and posing for pictures with, you know, a signed Bears jersey with the president. And, you know, knowing that this is somehow playing out within his family on a very personal level. You know, I grew up loving the Bears. I grew up idolizing Mike Ditka. I grew up loving Walter Payton. But, you know, why we care about what they think about politics and issues like that has long been beyond me.
Well, you know, I was talking to one of my kids about it, and it's like you spend so much of your time crafting a persona, whether it's genuine or not, post-season. I mean, and those are the billboards and all of that. I don't understand what makes you think that you need to. Sure, you're right. Maybe you're sacrificing some rights to speak out, but damn, you're only going to hurt yourself if you do that.
Think of your pocketbook.
Think
man.
Of your pocketbook.
Well, I want to take a little bit of an issue with what Heather said, because there are athletes like LeBron James who are told to shut up and dribble. And I think that it's really admirable that people like LeBron James use the pulpit that they have to advance causes they believe in. So I don't have a problem with in principle, Ditka and Urlacher using their pulpits.
Because I think LeBron James, you can talk about what he's done to fight for racial equity and what he's done sort of like to put his money where his mouth is on these sort of issues. I haven't seen Urlacher do anything but like a few posts on social media and go visit the White House. So I see those two cases as sort of diametrically opposed. You know, LeBron has sort of he has put the work in, whereas, you know, I don't see Urlacher having sort of earned that sort of, well, here's what I've done and here's what I think about it, sort of benefit of the doubt that LeBron gets.
On the other hand, the poor Speaker of the House was duped. Nancy Pelosi gets her hair cut in San Francisco. In San Francisco, you're not supposed to get your hair cut inside. And she said that she was set up, and then said that she apologized for, I forget the words exactly, but
as it turns out, it was a setup. So I take responsibility for falling for a setup.
And if you talk about missing the mark, I mean, come on, Nancy, you screwed up.
I will push back again a little bit.
Okay.
So the man who cut Nancy Pelosi's hair today, or put out a statement saying, no, she was set up. And apparently the owner of the salon is in the process of moving from San Francisco, a very blue part of California, to Fresno, which is a very red part of California, and that she has all these sort of GoFundMes set up with sort of Trump supporters. And he said that he has the owner of the salon on tape saying, yes, bring Nancy Pelosi in, cut her hair. We are going to videotape it and we are going to use it to raise money so we can move to Fresno. So that's on tape. So I think it's a little bit of a more
according to this guy. Yeah.
What's that? Yeah, I think
it's on tape according to whoever this guy.
Right. You know, it's a little bit more complicated than, you know.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, legally speaking, you shouldn't set somebody up, right? I mean, it would be some sort of entrapment or whatever. But you have to be purer than Caesar's husband, whatever the case would be when you say that.
Yes.
The female speaker, but you can't.
Sorry, just you can't say, like
you, know, you can't say, if you're the speaker of the house, you can't say, yeah, there was a dead body in my trunk, but you have no right to look there.
Right.
You know, that may get you off in court, but it's not going to get you off in the court of public opinion. You know, you can only set somebody up for something like that if they're kind of inclined to do it.
And she should have been on top of what the regulations are. So maybe she was set up, Heather, and I'll give you that. And I'll give her the Iowa set up defense. But what you got to say is I screwed up. I should have known the regulations. I should have known the restrictions. They told me it was okay, but this one's on me and I shouldn't have done it.
Absolutely. She's also got a staff where she could have said to her staff, go figure out the regulations I need to get my hair cut. How can I do that correctly? Full stop.
Yeah, we had basically the same situation with Lori Lightfoot earlier in the year, right? Where she 100%. Had a little different situation,
except
but she had.
Except Lori took a selfie with the person who cut her hair and then was outraged when she was asked about it by the news media.
I'm out in the public eye and I take my personal hygiene very seriously, so I got a haircut.
So I think that, you know,
Mayor take the selfie or did the stylist take the selfie?
The woman cutting her hair did.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a real own goal by Pelosi and her response. Again, it's one of those things where it's not so much what you do, it's how you cover it up, how you respond to something that goes wrong.
I think in this case, it's how you color it. That would be the way to say it.
Oh, it's highlighted.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you how it's being highlighted. I think it was half of the White House briefing today of McEnany calling for her to apologize publicly. You know, so they're trying to make the most out of it, out of a silly issue. If she had just said, I made a mistake, I think would have gone away much more quickly.
To the point about the action itself, like it's become a pattern. I think it's not just we talked about Lightfoot. Pritzker had to deal with the same thing, sending his family to another state. Governor Whitmer's husband, right, was trying to get a boat out in Michigan. De Blasio went to the gym. There's a ton of these, do as I say and not as I do things. And I think the difference with Pelosi was she totally punched down when she got caught.
Right.
And she's the most powerful Democratic person in the world. And she just totally dragged the small business owner who maybe she is, you know, super right wing nut, but like is relative to Nancy Pelosi in a much worse spot in life than the Speaker of the House, you know?
All right, hairstyling probably is and since John Williams isn't here, he spends more time on his hair than any of the five of us do. So this might be a time to say goodbye. Anything else you guys want to talk about?
Oh, I just want to make a pitch for my column in tomorrow's paper, which is going to be about why I think Kyle Rittenhouse, the shooter in Kenosha, is going to get off on self-defense claims.
You know, but he could on the second round, right? But what about the first shooting?
The first shooting, he was being chased. The video shows that he was being chased. He was chased into that parking lot of a used car dealer. And the guy, according to the witness, said that they grabbed for his gun. And if you're being chased and then someone grabs for your gun, I think you can plausibly say that you were in fear of death or great bodily harm, which is all he's got to claim in that moment. And the state's going to have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he wasn't. And then the other situation where he's being chased down the street, he falls down and people start kicking at his head and swinging skateboards at him. Again, you know, in that moment where there's all other gunfire going off, you've got a situation where a 17-year-old kid, I think, is in reasonable fear that this mob is out to get him. I mean, that doesn't mean that I think he should have been there.
No.
Or that he was carrying his gun legally or that I support open carry or any of that stuff. I just think I think looking at the law up there, that he is not going to serve any prison time.
What a world we live in where a 17-year-old could take a gun like that up to a place where he has no ties and get involved in this. It's an amazing thing.
And I think he's going to walk for it.
All right. I could see that. All right. That's in the paper tomorrow.
It's in the paper tomorrow, probably online tonight.
Eric Zorn, Heather Cerrone, Austin Berg. Thanks, boys. Thanks, girl.
You're welcome.
It's the Mincing Rascals. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.